Imagine building like the most devoted explosive fan base in modern political history.
Oh, yeah.
But you know that the absolute second the lead singer walks off the stage,
half the arena just leaves.
Right. They leave the building and, you know, they never come back. Or on the flip side, imagine trying to balance this wildly diverse coalition where fixing a leak on one side of your ship mathematically threatens to just
sink the other side.
Exactly. It sinks the whole thing. And that is the reality of the game board we are looking at today. We're pulling back the curtain on the structural mechanics of securing 270 electoral votes. And suddenly that traditional, you know, boxing match narrative we always hear about, it just vanishes entirely.
It really does. I mean, we are looking at a massive, complex landscape of geography, data, economics, and, well, totally fragmented media.
Yeah.
It's the absolute definition of a structural, multidimensional puzzle. Okay. And the pieces are just constantly shifting.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking under the hood of American presidential politics.
And it is a fascinating engine.
It really is. Our specific focus today is the 2028 U.S. presidential election. And our source material for this is a comprehensive, freshly published report. It's titled The Strategic Architecture of the 2028 U.S. Presidential Election. And it's dated today, August 13th, 2026.
Brand new.
Hot off the presses. Now, look, I want to be incredibly clear with you right up front. Our mission today is to treat this election not as a, you know, a binary political fight. We're treating it as an integrated 270-vote system.
Right. The raw mechanics.
Yes, the mechanics. We are going to look at the strategies of both the Democratic and Republican parties with absolute neutrality.
Mm.
We are not here to endorse any political viewpoint, left or right, period. Our only goal is to impartially report on the structural mechanics and the internal theories of victory that both sides are operating under exactly as they're laid out in the source document.
Yeah, it is entirely about understanding the how and the why. Taking the emotion completely out of the equation, we're just evaluating the architectural blueprints that are currently on the table.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can talk about how anyone plans to mathematically win in 2028, we have to establish the exact reality on the ground today, like right now in August of 2026.
And that baseline reality is highly fluid. Primarily because, well, the 2026 midterm elections haven't actually happened yet.
Right.
They're scheduled for November 3rd. So campaigns are operating in an environment where control of Congress is split by, I mean, barely a handful of seats.
It's a knife's edge. Let's see. It's a House of 218 Republicans.
Right. And 212 Democrats.
And the Senate is sitting at 53 Republicans and 45 Democrats.
Exactly. It is a total deadlock. Any long-term strategy for 2028 is going to pivot entirely on whether voters decide to reinforce the current governing party or, you know, mandate a change in just a few short months.
And a massive driver of that midterm choice and ultimately the 2028 landscape, honestly, is the economy.
Oh, absolutely. Always is.
But the indicators here, they present a deeply contradictory picture for campaigns to navigate. I mean, on paper, we're seeing modest GDP growth.
About 1.5%.
Right, 1.5%. But underneath that, the consumer price index, the CPI, which is really just a technical term for what you actually pay for everyday goods at the store.
Yeah, your groceries.
Exactly. That is sitting at 3.4% year over year. Unemployment is hovering at 4.1%. And non-farm payrolls just saw this sudden drop.
Right. Yeah, minus 23,000 in July.
Minus 23,000. So
that mix of data creates a very distinct political headache because, look, it's not a classic deep recession, right, which usually guarantees a massive anti-incumbent wave.
Right. People aren't panicking in the streets.
No, but nobody feels like they're operating in a booming economy either. You have elevated energy prices, hiring costs. The Fed rate is sitting between 3.5% and 3.75%.
Ouch.
Yeah. And undeniable chronic pressure on basic essentials.
Which, you know, brings up something I always think about when we talk macroeconomics. It's like looking at a massive corporate spreadsheet.
How so?
Well, the CEO can point to the top line numbers and say, look, our aggregate revenue is up 1.5%. The company is growing.
Right, right.
But the frontline employee, or in this case, you, the voter, you only care about your own household budget. Statistical macroeconomic growth means absolutely nothing to you if your rent, your grocery bill, and your mortgage rates are suffocating you on a daily basis.
That is exactly it. And the report explicitly calls this the personal economy test.
The personal economy test.
Yeah. When a campaign strategist is looking at your demographic profile, they aren't asking if you academically believe the GDP is expanding.
No one votes based on academic GDP.
No, they're designing a highly targeted message based entirely on whether your specific life feels more affordable and secure right now compared to 4 years ago.
Interesting.
The governing party has to somehow claim credit for that statistical growth without sounding, you know, hopelessly out of touch with the pain of a $100 grocery trip.
While the opposition...
Right. The opposition has to offer concrete mechanical alternatives. They can't just point at high prices and complain.
Right, because complaining isn't a policy. So knowing that intense economic squeeze is what you and millions of other voters are feeling, let's look at how the opposition party, the Democrats in this cycle, is trying to build a mathematical path to 270 electoral votes.
And they are starting from a deficit.
Yeah, a big one.
Yeah.
Looking at the 2024 map that Kamala Harris secured, they have a baseline of 226 electoral votes. So they need exactly 44 more to win.
The clearest geographic path for them is what the document calls the minimum state recovery route.
Through the blue wall.
Exactly, through the blue wall. If they hold their 2024 baseline and manage to flip Pennsylvania with its 19 votes,
Michigan with 15,
and Wisconsin with 10, they hit exactly 270.
Nothing more, nothing less.
Exactly 270.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because we talk about flipping these states as if it requires some massive tidal wave of new voters, right?
Yeah, people assume it's this huge shift.
But when you look at the 2024 margins, Donald Trump won Wisconsin by just 0.9 points. He won Michigan by 1.4 points. And Pennsylvania by 1.7 points.
We are talking about microscopic shifts.
Microscopic. Functionally, changing the minds of just a few thousand people in a few specific counties completely rewires the global power structure.
Structurally, it is a very compact math problem. But, as we know, mathematically simple does not mean politically easy.
Obviously not.
The Democrats face a massive vulnerability that the report defines as coalition repair without coalition substitution.
Okay, let's translate that into how campaigns actually operate on the ground. What does that mean?
It means the Democratic voter base has fundamentally transformed, and they're now trying to hold together two groups with incredibly different priorities.
Okay.
Look at 2024. They did remarkably well with highly educated voters, winning college graduates by 16 points.
Huge margin.
And they won women overall by 7 points, but they suffered severe erosion with the working class.
Right.
They lost non-college voters by 14 points overall. And more crucially, their margins slipped significantly with Hispanic voters.
Mm.
Trump actually reached 48% with that demographic.
Wow, 48%.
Yeah. And they also struggled to hold their traditional numbers with younger men and some black men.
See, this is where I struggle to see how the mechanics of their strategy actually work.
How so?
Because to rebuild that blue wall in places like, say, industrial Pennsylvania or Michigan, they need those non-college working class voters back.
Mathematically, yes.
But to do that, you'd assume they need this gritty, material-focused economic populist campaign. Something talks purely about wages and tariffs.
Right.
The problem is they cannot afford to alienate the highly educated suburban institutionalists, the ones who care deeply about abstract concepts like preserving democratic norms and reproductive rights.
Yeah, it's a tension.
It's like trying to balance a seesaw. The harder you lean into working class economic anger to win back the Midwest, the more you risk launching your moderate suburban voters right off the other side.
What's fascinating here is how campaign architects actually plan to engineer a bridge across that exact divide. They know they can't run two entirely disconnected campaigns.
They just sound like hypocrites.
Exactly. So the strategy outlined in the report is to aggressively connect those abstract institutional issues directly to everyday material outcomes.
Ah, so they have to make the philosophical feel financial.
Precisely. They have to argue that a threat to democratic institutions or reproductive rights is functionally a threat to a voter's bodily autonomy, and that autonomy dictates their economic stability, their family's healthcare costs.
So taking something like abortion access.
Right. And framing it not just as a fundamental right, but as a core pillar of family economic planning.
Wow.
They have to make the abstract feel economically tangible to the working class while ensuring the economic populism doesn't sound too, you know, radical or destabilizing to the suburban moderates who really just want steady governance.
It is a massive, incredibly delicate threading of the needle.
It really is.
Now, because every action in this system has an equal and opposite reaction, let's look at how the Republicans are structurally positioned. While the Democrats were walking this tightrope to scrape together exactly 44 votes, the Republicans are sitting inside a massive electoral fortress.
a fortress of 312 electoral votes from the 2024 election.
Right.
And that fortress provides them with the ultimate luxury in presidential politics.
Yes.
Redundancy.
Right.
The Republicans do not need a perfect map to secure 270. They have multiple overlapping pathways. They could completely lose Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia.
Which is what, 33 electoral votes?
Yes, 33 votes. They could lose all three and still win the presidency with 279.
That's incredible.
Or if they hold the Sun Belt, those fast-growing states across the South and Southwest, they could lose both Pennsylvania and Michigan. That's 34 votes, and they'd still win with 278.
That is a staggering strategic cushion.
Yeah.
But, you know, just because the walls of the fortress are high doesn't mean everything is stable in the courtyard.
Very true.
The report highlights that they are facing a completely different structural crisis internally.
Yeah, the central Republican vulnerability is the unprecedented challenge of Trumpism without Trump. Donald Trump engineered a highly unique, surprisingly diverse coalition in 2024. He didn't just turn out traditional, reliable conservatives. He reached 40% of Asian voters and 15% of Black voters.
Those are huge shifts for a Republican.
Massive. And the mechanism that made this possible was his ability to mobilize a huge block of low propensity voters.
And just to define that for a second for anyone listening, low propensity voters are people who are legally registered, but historically they just don't bother to show up to the polls.
Right.
They are notoriously difficult for pollsters to track and even harder for campaigns to reach.
And yet they swung the 2024 election. The data shows that people who were eligible but did not vote in 2020,
correct,
but then suddenly decided to cast a ballot in 2024, they favored Trump by a massive 54% to 42% margin.
Wow. See, my brain immediately goes to a restaurant analogy here.
Let's hear it.
Imagine a world famous, volatile, incredibly theatrical celebrity chef leaves their flagship restaurant. The diners didn't just come for the ingredients on the plate, right? They came for the spectacle, the personality, the specific way the chef yelled from the open kitchen.
Yeah, the whole experience.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring in a highly competent sous chef, they can't keep those exact same diners coming back just by following the recipe card.
Mm.
The diners were there for the aura. The Republican Party is trying to figure out if they can hand this personality-driven coalition over to a successor without the whole thing evaporating.
This raises an important question, and it is the structural dilemma keeping Republican strategists awake tonight.
Which is?
Can you inherit a populist movement without the populist man? If you look at early 2026 polling for potential Republican successors, the base is perfectly fractured.
Really?
Yeah. You have J.D. Vance sitting at roughly 39% and Marco Rubio at 38%.
39 to 38. That isn't just a tight race. That is a dead split.
Right. It indicates the base has absolutely no unified vision for what kind of continuity they actually want.
But the natural assumption would be that Trump just picks someone, raises their hand at a rally, and the entire coalition instantly transfers their loyalty, right? Like an endorsement acts as a magic wand.
You'd think so, but the mechanics of this specific coalition suggest otherwise.
Really?
Yeah, the report points to a recent poll from New Hampshire where likely Republican primary voters were asked this exact question.
Okay.
While two-thirds said they wanted a nominee who builds on Trump's presidency, fewer than half said a direct endorsement from Trump would actually make them more likely to support a candidate.
That is wild. I mean, it means the loyalty is to the spectacle, not the stamp of approval.
Exactly. It implies the coalition is bound by Trump's unique earned media capacity, his highly specific brand of conflict politics, and just his sheer gravitational pull.
So a normal politician comes in.
Right. If a successor comes in using a more disciplined managerial tone, they might successfully make those moderate suburban voters feel more comfortable. But in doing so, they risk completely demobilizing the exact working class, low propensity voters who only ever showed up for the spectacle. The sous chef might cook a safer meal, but the dining room empties out.
The dining room empties out. So we have two massive, incredibly fragile coalitions. The Democrats are trying to balance a seesaw of working class anger and suburban institutionalism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the Republicans are trying to figure out how to keep a personality cult engaged without the personality. But, you know, having the perfect theoretical blueprint on a whiteboard means absolutely nothing if you can't actually deliver that message to the voters.
Right. Delivery is everything.
And this brings us to the delivery mechanism itself, which is completely fractured since the last cycle.
Oh, completely. The era of buying a 30-second broadcast TV ad, running it during the evening news, and assuming you've reached the American electorate, that's entirely over.
Just dead.
Dead. I mean, television still has some utility for older, high-propensity voters, you know, the people who vote in every election no matter what.
Right.
But to reach those critical, low-propensity voters, especially the younger men who heavily swung the 2024 map, campaigns have had to completely abandon traditional architecture.
So if traditional TV is dead for reaching those specific demographics, campaigns are basically forced to become decentralized digital media companies.
Yeah,
right?
Basically, yeah.
Instead of buying ad time, they're trying to buy space inside totally non-political environments.
They are entirely bypassing institutional gatekeepers.
Yeah.
A candidate's media portfolio now prioritizes, you know, sitting down for a three-hour unedited conversation on a massive comedy podcast.
Or doing a spot on a YouTube gaming stream.
Right. Or appearing alongside finance influencers. The goal is to project a conversational, unfiltered authenticity to audiences who actively distrust and avoid traditional political news networks.
But there has to be a massive mechanical flaw in that strategy.
Well, there is risk, sure.
I mean, you want authenticity, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when a candidate is sitting on a live podcast talking for 3 hours without a teleprompter, doesn't authenticity quickly just become unmanaged exposure?
Yeah.
A candidate is mathematically bound to say something slightly off script in hour two. And suddenly that 1 5-second slip-up is clipped, taken out of context, and becomes a permanent meme that dominates the news cycle for a month.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you've just identified exactly where artificial intelligence has rewired the operational battlefield.
Okay, AI.
We hear so much anxiety about AI generating deepfakes or synthetic audio.
It's just terrifying.
Which is a legitimate threat. And campaigns have massive rapid response teams dedicated to neutralizing it. But the true daily operational power of AI in 2028 is about scale, velocity, and micro-targeting.
How does that actually work in practice? Walk me through the mechanism.
Okay, let's take that three-hour podcast interview. As soon as it airs, a campaign feeds the raw audio and video into proprietary AI tools.
Instantly.
Within minutes. The AI identifies the highest engagement moments, the most emotional statements, and the best sound bites.
Whoa.
And it doesn't just cut one clip. It generates dozens of highly targeted, platform-native pieces of content.
So it's formatting it.
Yes, it reformats one clip vertically for TikTok, another for YouTube Shorts. It instantly translates the audio into Spanish with perfectly synced lip movements to target voters in a specific zip code in Arizona.
That is insane.
It tests 10 different thumbnail images in real time to see which one a 22-year-old male in Wisconsin is most likely to click on.
It's an absolute content velocity machine. It takes one raw input and weaponizes it into 1,000 different highly personalized projectiles.
And the structural advantage doesn't necessarily belong to the party with the most expensive AI software.
Yeah.
No, it belongs to the campaign infrastructure that has the fastest approval protocols, the best human verification to ensure the AI didn't accidentally, you know, alter the message.
Oh, right. AI hallucinations.
Exactly. And they need the ability to maintain narrative discipline across thousands of isolated digital micro communities simultaneously.
So what does this all mean? When you step back and look at the entire board at the knife edge Congress, the suffocating personal economy, the fragile coalitions on both sides, and this hyper-fragmented AI media landscape, where does this actually leave the country heading into 2028?
It leaves us looking at a deeply competitive, highly volatile mechanism where neither party possesses a definitive structural advantage.
It's a jump ball.
Basically. The Republicans have the luxury of map redundancy, but they face an existential crisis in trying to replicate a personality-driven turnout machine without the persona.
Right.
The Democrats have a very clear, mathematically compact path through the Great Lakes, but they have to execute an almost impossible messaging maneuver to repair relationships with the working class without alienating their suburban base.
It isn't a national election anymore, is it? What we're really looking at is thousands of highly specific micro-elections fought across totally different cultural and economic realities, all happening at exactly the same time.
It ultimately comes down to execution. The winner will be the campaign that can take these abstract blueprints, navigate the AI media fragmentation, and actually pull 270 electoral votes out of an electorate that is exhausted and overwhelmed by information.
Which brings me to a final thought I want to leave with you, the listener. Think about your own media diet this past week. Think about the random, totally non-political podcasts you listen to while you commute.
Or the influencers.
Yeah, the niche fitness or finance influencers you follow on Instagram. The hyper-specific YouTube channels you fall asleep to. You probably think you're just enjoying some downtime, totally disconnected from politics.
But they're watching.
They are. To a 2028 campaign strategist, your specific, highly personal digital footprint isn't just data. It is the exact, unmapped battlefield where the next presidency will be decided. They're using AI to find you exactly where you are hiding. You are the target of that supply chain. It's not just a boxing match you watch on TV anymore. The ring is being built around you, in your phone, in your budget, and in your daily life. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the information around you. Always look for the mechanics beneath the narrative, and we'll see you next time.